My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work. Today I'm talking with Letitia Zadrozny-Zelaya. Welcome. Thanks for talking with me this morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk with you, considering you are on the other side of the country as me. So I'm very curious and interested in your perspective. And I got to know of you when I came across your website.
Yeah, I'm actually a little surprised you ran into it. I mostly make it for just within my school setting and local psychologist just within my district, and it's obviously open to the public, but I don't really advertise it. It's not a blog. I don't get money or paid for it. It's just something that I do for fun.
Yeah, it's a great resource. Definitely have a lot of resources that, even though it's meant for more local usage, I think a lot of school psychologists would really love to look at it and would get a lot out of it. On your website, what really interested me and fascinated me was that you say you have the same approach to your students as the little boy in the starfish story. And I had never heard of the starfish story, actually, until I read it on your website. For those that aren't familiar with it, can you give a summary and explain how it's connected to your approach as a practitioner?
Yeah, actually, I just recently found the starfish story, and I'm really love ocean and just being near the beach. I actually did a lot of surfing in undergrad. I went to UC Santa Cruz for my undergraduate, and I was just searching random things, and I came across a story, and it talks about a little boy walking along the beach, picking up items and throwing them into the ocean, and just haphazardly doing it. And there's a man that comes across and asks him, like, what are you doing? And the little boy explains, well, there are these starfish and I need to throw them back in the water because the tide's gonna go out, and if they aren't in water, then they won't survive. So I'm throwing them back in so they are able to survive. And the man asks us, like, well, there's millions of starfish here on the beach. How are you gonna get to all of them? Like, what difference is it gonna make? And the little boy doesn't really answer, and he picks up the next starfish and throws it back in the water. And he says, well, it matters to that one. It just really connected with me of there are millions of students, millions of people in this world, and it can be overwhelming when you're looking at things. But when you take the time to kind of just focus on the few that you're working with, that's where it really matters. And you just pick that one student that you kind of focus on for a little bit and hope that it makes an impact on them. And then you move on to the next one. And even though you may not get to the millions of other people, you're making a difference in that one. And that kind of made me start thinking as well of, like, I hope that makes a riptide, like a little ripple. And just, if I help this one person, maybe they gain the skills and they can help their peers. Or if I help a teacher, they can help, you know, their colleagues. And that creates a ripple effect that turns into a wave, and it just becomes bigger and bigger. So it helped me with my own mental health of understanding you can't get to everyone, you can't save everyone, but you should focus on the one that you are working with, and hope that that does translate to a bigger picture eventually.
Wonderful. I like that. I like the idea of a ripple effect. It really does help put things into perspective, because you're right. I think we do often kind of go in and we have this mindset of we're going to kind of save everyone and save the day and save the school. But that's not realistic and it's not healthy.
Yeah, definitely.
In addition to your day-to-day practice, you take a lot of leadership roles in the, especially in the Bay Area Association of School Psychologists. And then you do a lot of work with the Multicultural Affairs and Diversity Committee. You're a member of the Northern California Bilingual Roundtable. It's a lot. Talk about your work with these organizations and what kind of led you to become involved as a practitioner.
So It all kind of snowballed. So I actually found out about the bilingual roundtable in graduate school. There is not a lot of education as a bilingual psychologist. You kind of have to figure it out on your own, especially when I started grad school 10 years ago. And bilingual psychologists has been around for a long time now. And a lot of it has been kind of teaching ourselves and figuring things out. So I joined this roundtable as an intern in 2007, 2008, somewhere around there, to kind of just get a better understanding because my program, there aren't very many programs that teach you bilingual assessments. The test kits that are out there, we kind of have to figure it out on our own. So I kind of joined this group to get a better understanding. And I've been on and off with this group, like I said, for the past 10 years. I actually took a long break when I did start working in the field. But I reconnected with everyone about 6 years ago. And it's just a group of people who get together talking about cases and how to problem solve, because it is one of the big things about being a school psychologist is being able to have discussions with your colleagues to be able to bounce ideas off. And then I attended a CASC conference, and that's just California Association of School Psychologists. It's our state association. And I kind of met a couple people, and I ran into another old colleague that I had worked with previously, but she had moved on to a different district. And she introduced me to a lot of the leaders in the association, the president at the time, and a couple of the people who were involved in committees. And I kind of just got connected with them, and I was really motivated and inspired of how much work they did and how much they actually made a difference within our state, because not only do they do things within the association, but they connect with legislators and advocate for who we are and what we do in the field and how that impacts laws, which I feel like is a really big deal in the way we work. Sometimes, especially when I started out, it felt very strange of having these people create laws and guidelines for our profession that doesn't, where people don't understand what our profession actually does. So I got really inspired to kind of work with them. So I've been part of CASP for about 5, 6 years now. And I was always just a member, and I'd go to the conferences, and little by little, I started meeting more people who were involved on the executive board. And 2 years ago, I would start just kind of chatting with people on the work that I do at the Bilingual Roundtable and how that affects my practice. And one of the president-elect a couple of years ago said, "Hey, would you like to chair our committee? We've had it for a while, but we don't have anyone really do much. We're still trying to figure it out how to get it up and running." And at the time, I was pregnant, so I was like, "Well, I'd love to, but I don't know how effective I would be." And she was like, "You know what? Just do it. It's better than having nothing." So, didn't really do a lot last year because I was pregnant, but I was able to connect with a couple people, get a couple workshops together. One of the things I was able to do was serve as a consultant on a presentation created for the CDE. And this was the Hispanic Latinx Students and Significant Disproportionality presentation. And just to kind of have the CDE have an understanding of the difficulties we're coming up against for students of color, specifically Hispanic students, bilingual students, where a lot of Hispanic students are being categorized as special ed students, but in reality, it's just part of being a second language learner. It's the fact that second language learners' brains work differently, and it's not a disability, it's learning differently. And we, and I say we because I am a second language learner, are taught and learn new information slightly differently and at a, well, people say at a delayed response, but it is normal for people who know multiple languages. And there are studies that say that it, compared to monolinguals, it does take bilingual students to catch up in academics. But honestly, it research says it takes 5 to 7 years. So by middle school, end of middle school to high school, they're just as proficient and you're able to keep up with monolingual students and then have the benefit of having two or multiple languages. So that is one of the big things that I did do with the Multicultural Affairs and Diversity Issues Committee is being able to spread this information out that it's not being a second language learner or being a multilingual learner is not a disability and shouldn't qualify under special education, but we should invest in resources, especially in the United States where we have a diverse population and just a melting pot of cultures and languages. So that was one of the big things. This year, I'm actually getting a big group of people. Last year, we had about 3 people on the committee. This year, I have 10. So we are slightly growing. We're still going to be a smallish committee. Our max is 12, of just being able to gather research information and share it, not only within our school psychologist colleagues, but with the state association, state legislators, and just understanding how their laws or their guidelines are impacting our students.
Awesome that you're doing that work.
Yeah.
And it made me think of, you know, as school psychologists, when we're sitting with our teams in that problem solving process and we come across a student who may be a dual language learner, that's really important to advocate at that time.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the biggest difficulties that I run across is I know the difference and I try to convey it to the teachers, but then in the end, that's great. People understand that academic language is going to come later after social language, but how do we help those students catch up? And the only answer we currently have is special education. So it's always this, well, if we give the students special education, they'll be able to catch up, but it's not necessarily geared to what the student needs. And I know that schools have difficulty getting funding and understanding what those programs may look like or what services would look like. And so we always get caught up of, well, we want to help the student, but the only way we can help the student is through special education because that's all the school has. And I hate that. So that's our current dilemma that I'm trying to figure out. Actually, that's been put on the back burner since this whole COVID distance learning, because that is definitely creating a much bigger digital divide within our communities. And I think that's where it becomes very important to go to the legislative level of, hey, we need to start providing funding to schools and making sure that they're, because I know right now funding is divided between general education and special ed funds. And where do the funds for English language learners come from? Like, there should be a set amount and looking to be able to have those funds and then understanding what services go for these funds, making sure they're evidence-based, making sure that it works for our students. And because it's difficult, because it is left up to each individual, I'd say SELPA, but also school, a school district, of how to target these students.
You talked about how there isn't a lot of instruction for future bilingual psychologists and training programs, meaning that there's not always a course where they teach you how to administer bilingual assessments. And I think that may be surprising to a lot of people. It certainly is surprising to me. But I'm wondering if you think this is maybe a larger issue that might be sort of a reflection of the lack of school psychologists of color in the field, or lack of faculty members of color in the field of school psychology.
I know that's definitely a big piece. I know that for myself, when I was in grad school, I did not have actually any school psychology faculty of color, really. So they did encourage me to go out and find people and connect with people. Sometimes the school connected me with people. And that's actually how I found the Bilingual Roundtable.
But it is this circle of chicken and egg thing of how do we get more bilingual psychologists? Well, we need to train them by bilingual psychologists, but if we don't have any, how is that going to work? So, in the last 10 years or so, I've definitely seen an increase, but it is still very slow going. I know that NASP has a few programs that are multicultural and bilingual focused, but I don't know if those programs again teach people the tests. As part of the bilingual roundtable, I do know of a school psychologist who is bilingual and is a teacher at Sacramento State here in California, and I know she does teach the bilingual assessments, but I don't know of anyone else, and she just started within the last 10 years. So I know it's slow going, and being able to share that information is really difficult. So one of the goals that I have for the bilingual roundtable is really finding those programs that have bilingual faculty that can start helping people assess. I know that almost all of our programs definitely focus on cultural competence and working with different cultures. But in terms of the specific bilingual piece, I don't know very many. Actually, I don't know of any other than Sacramento State. I have found a couple graduate school programs here in California that have some, like I said, some bilingual faculty. But it'd be nice to see it grow and just having some sort of coursework that goes through that. It is very similar to our English tests, which is very nice, but there are a lot of other things to consider. I know in my daily routine, I use a lot of bilingual assessments and a lot of nonverbal assessments. And I find that my reports for multilingual learners are a lot lengthier than monolingual students, because there are a lot of different things to consider.
For sure. I have a friend who is a bilingual school psychologist, and he often says that, and just because he speaks two languages doesn't automatically make him a bilingual school psychologist. He's had to sort of train and practice and, learn how to be one.
Yes, I think that is a big key thing of explaining to people is just because, and I know for myself, I speak English and Spanish, but I basically had to reteach myself how to speak Spanish in terms of a graduate level program of being able to have those just the dialect and words and still be able to communicate with colleagues in Spanish and with parents, because you can't use a lot of jargon. And it was a big learning curve, and I honestly didn't feel very comfortable doing it early on. And I've noticed that my Spanish skills have definitely increased a lot more just the practice. But that is what I encourage. I've been very thankful to have a few bilingual school psychologist interns and just kind of having them shadow me and see what I do and sharing information with them of just you just need to keep practicing and find some kiddos that you just need to test. And I know that my youngest sister is very tired of me testing her because she has been my guinea pig for at least the last 12 years. She was the perfect age in middle school when I was learning how to do tests. So I did a lot of the WISC and WJ and RAML and UNIT on her. And now that we're doing distance learning, she's 25. And I told her, I was like, I need you to log into Zoom and I need to start testing you with distance learning so I can start practicing that. So, and I'm very fortunate that I have that. But I know in terms of bilingual students, it's hard to go find other bilingual students to practice on or just being able to find those families who are willing to do so.
Hopefully, we will see more progress in this area in the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things I definitely want to start tackling with our bilingual team in Northern California and hopefully with the Multicultural Affairs and Diversity Issues Committee is being able to expand that to Southern California of finding some sort of guidelines and maybe just finding people who can start teaching these tests.
I wanted to also ask you what your thoughts and feelings have been as a school psychologist of color in the midst of racial tensions in the country and our current political climate.
Well, it's definitely been a bigger issue, at least in the past 4 years. So during the 2016 election, I worked in a middle school with a large Hispanic population. And just the anxiety and fears of students coming into the office and being scared of their families being deported or even themselves being deported was very big. And then just recently, obviously within the last couple of months, this has expanded even more so. And it's made me more aware of things because I always knew about the fear for my Hispanic population. And I knew that for my Black students, it was always difficult and having teachers kind of understand them, but it's now more in the forefront of I still had to look at my biases and see things of like, yes, well, it's hard for everyone, but it is different. Again, seeing how English language learners learn differently, my Black students are just coming in with a lot more difficulty and now are saying, well, like, see, this is what I told you. I've been telling you this for years, and it's finally coming across, and it makes me look at my own biases and just kind of take a step back and reevaluate things. It made me reevaluate a lot of my previous students of them getting frustrated, getting in trouble, and not being able to follow directions. And a part of it would be just how they were being treated, and they see that things would be different. So I know for myself, I've definitely had to reevaluate a lot of things, and I'm very grateful that I know a lot of my teacher colleagues who have done the same thing and had to take a step back and realize maybe the way I was responding would trigger some of these students and would escalate things more than they should be. So I know that this has been a very important thing in just my field and just for personally, especially because I do work with a large population of students of different backgrounds, different colors, and normally, I do work with a lot of Hispanic populations, but it being in the Bay Area, it is we are the big melting pot of just every culture we can possibly think of.
In addition to the pandemic, you're also dealing with the impact of the wildfires. What has that impact been?
Yes, it is a new thing every day. In terms of the wildfires, there has been a big shift. Especially for my students, there has been the pandemic, which limits their ability to go and socialize with their peers in a school setting. And then we used to try to encourage them to at least get outside in their backyards and do things because they are stuck inside in front of a computer. But with our wildfires, it is creating a bigger impact in terms of just their health of not even being able to go out and see sunshine. I know that's definitely impacted me personally, in terms of not being able to go outside and do things. But I know a lot of my students like to go out, ride their bikes, hang out with friends, and just be outside, especially in, I mean, it's still warm. We are still in the hundreds here in Northern California, and it is October.
Gotta be so difficult. We're already sort of required to stay at home as much as possible because of the pandemic, and now there's this whole air quality issue they have to deal with.
Yes, it is a tough choice that just a lot of people here in the Bay Area and just California are dealing with up and down California. I forget that they're basically the West Coast is on fire just from Oregon down to Southern California. Of their mental health is impacted because they can't go out and socialize with peers. And so they're stuck inside, but then they can't go out and, exercise being outdoors is a big part of being able to go out and be healthy. And everyone's just kind of stuck inside. And it's a huge impact on on everyone around us, not only students, but our staff as well.
You are in your 10th year as a practitioner, and you're encountering all of these issues that impact both you, your neighbors, and your students, and thus your practice. And these issues, I don't think we were expecting to be here 10 years ago. We weren't expecting to be in a global pandemic at the very least. But then there's also sort of the really big impact of climate change, the more openly discriminatory and bigoted language from many of our political leaders. Over these 10 years, how have your perspective or priorities as a practitioner shifted? And what do you sort of wish you knew 10 years ago?
I don't know. It's just being older and just seeing things in the world, or just being more educated in what's going around me. But 10 years ago, it was definitely go find students and help them with their academics and their mental health and their families and kind of go from there. And it's definitely changed. And it was help all the students all the time and get to everyone, which definitely impacted my own mental health because you can't get to everyone. But just taking a step back and seeing everything in terms of how the world around us impacts students. And it should be, we were always taught in grad school to do things more preventative measure instead of going around and putting out fires, is the way we put it in grad school, is learning to be preventative. And a lot of that has to do of, we've known about climate change. I mean, I remember being a kid and hearing about the ozone layer having a hole in it and what we could do to fix that. And then we did, and it's starting to heal. And like, that's great. And now this climate change thing is coming on, and everyone decided, no, we're not going to listen to this. And I know 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I definitely wasn't thinking about having a global pandemic, but people were talking about it then. We just weren't listening. And we've gotten to this point. And so one of the things I wish I knew 10 years ago is you can't get to everyone all the time, but you can start doing little things that help out the future. And that is not only for our students and providing mental health support and hoping that they come out okay, but doing things on a global scale as well of, hey, maybe I'm not going to go and buy bottled water every day because I have tap water and we filter it and it's just as easy, and just doing little things like that. And I know that's been a big shift even within my schools, is we usually have little student stores incentives and we hand out water bottles. And not only that, but then our district decided, well, we'll just put in refillable water stations instead of just drinking fountains. And I think educating ourselves and our students of how to prevent some of these things and make things a little bit better in the future is kind of a nice, I don't know, hopeful, optimistic point of view. And I'm trying as much as possible to kind of share this with my students. Actually, one of my counseling students recently decided he wanted to share a video with me. And I was like, you know what? It's his counseling session. And we're just starting out and doing, getting to know each other. And he shared a climate change video with me. And I just found it very, very impactful and just so ecstatic that a fourth grader, someone very, very young, wanted to share this with me. I was like, how do we fix this? How do we do this? And as someone so young, it's obviously a little anxiety inducing of like, this is a lot we have to take on. But it's nice to see that students are looking at things like this and are realizing it. And we can start teaching them little things that they can do to help our future. As adults, we definitely have to take on more and do more, including things all the way up to our state and our government. But yeah, I'm trying not to stress out about trying to change everything all at once, but learning to do the little things. And that definitely comes back to the starfish story of don't do everything, but just start finding little things. And I think that's one of the reasons that I started getting involved with so many different organizations and creating different things, is I can't do everything, but I can be a part of something here and there. And I I'll get to it when I get to it. And these organizations that I'm a part of, the Bilingual Roundtable meets 4 times a year. It's not that much. It doesn't take up too much of my time. So it's not every day. The Bay Area Association, we meet once a month to put on trainings. And again, it's once a month. The Multicultural Affairs is 3 times a year. So even though it looks like a lot throughout my schedule, I'm
Right.
not doing everything all at once, but I do want to make sure that I'm involved and I understand everything at every level because I don't have my own private practice. I don't do anything individually. I am in a school setting 100% of the time, public school setting, and that's always been my thing. I want to make sure I'm there at the forefront working with students. But I know that in order to create change, you have to go to the district and state and federal level. So I'm not a part of these organizations and doing things every day. It does look like a lot on paper, but it's taking the time and doing things little by little because we can do little things from just in terms of the pandemic of not going out or putting on a mask, washing our hands. Those are things that are almost everyone school age and beyond are very capable of doing. And climate change of being able to recycle or reducing just what we use. And it's a little bit harder with the bigotry language and the open racism that is going on, because as one of the things I thought of just recently, was it's really hard to teach our students to stand up against and things like that when we are seeing it in the media with adults almost every day. And I definitely hope that we're sheltering our students from that, but it's really hard to do that because it's, and politically through the presidential campaign, it's not just one side. It's definitely both sides saying terrible things about each other. And it's really hard to justify telling kids not to do that when adults are doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something we're all sort of struggling with. How do we talk to our students about that? How do we address these issues as they come up between students and schools?
Yes, and I know I always tell my students sometimes you have to be better than other people. And one of my students said, "Well, why do I have to be better than adults? They're adults." And I realized I was like, "Yeah, you're right." But sometimes adults aren't able to grow up and have that forward thinking and understanding that. And I know with my goal with each of my students is my goal is to make sure you are one of those adults one day that is able to do that. Because yes, there are a lot of kids who can't do that, who turn into adults.
Yeah, absolutely. To sort of bring it back to the starfish story, we are dealing with different crises. We're constantly thinking on our feet as school psychologists. Considering the scale of the crises that we are facing today, what have you been doing to take care of yourself, care for your own well-being, and make sure that you can be at your best as a practitioner?
This is definitely something I've struggled with, because just growing up in that mindset is you always take care of everyone first, especially as the role of being a woman and a mother, you take care of everyone. And I've really struggled with that. So it's been a lot of time to think about it, but I am very much a water person and decided that I need to start getting back into the water. So I think it's been 3 years ago. My husband bought me a stand-up paddle board. So I've been able to go out, or I used to consistently go out before I got pregnant and go paddle boarding. Not as much anymore because of fire and pandemic. But I have been looking to start swimming again. I swam competitively for almost 10 years. And I recently just got back in the pool, and that I am very fortunate that there is a local pool that is open, and you have to make reservations ahead of time so you have your own lane, which I love anyways. I wish I could always do that. And that is a big part. And then socially, I have a great group of colleagues through the California Association that I talk to almost every day. And it's not even about school psychology sometimes. It's just about life and our kids and our families, and just being able to share that with other people that I can also start sharing about my struggles at work or even my successes at work. If having other people understand where I'm coming from, because as you know, school psychologists are usually, it's usually a very lonely job because you're the only one on campus. But I have an awesome group that I talk to. And we, because of the pandemic, we're actually able to do Zoom like parties and get-togethers of just being able to talk and hang out. And that is a big key for my mental health, is being able to just talk to this group. And I love every single one of them. I love being able to talk to any of them at any time.
Wonderful. We're looking forward to the work that you're continuing to do. Thank you for your thoughts and experiences.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to The Leitner Side of Things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.